Introducing two new Subway melts. Try the new chicken cordon bleu melt stacked with juicy chicken, black forest ham, and melted cheese. Or the new $5 footlong chicken marinara melt. Tender chicken covered in marinara sauce and melted cheese. Melted goodness made irresistible. Subway melts. Subway. Eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. I am not writing a football column this week, so why not have Mike Lombardi from National Football Post come on and we can talk football? It could kind of be like a column, but not really. He's on the Subway Fresh Take hotline. What's happening?
With a lot of grammatical mistakes, I'm sure, whatever column I would do, right?
I'm not one to talk. All right. Well, you're probably the number one Belichick Kool-Aid drinker, so defend this season to me. Put the Kool-Aid down and defend it. Defend this notion that Bill Belichick is 57 years old and he's not throwing 99 miles an hour anymore. Make me think that that's not true.
I don't think that's true at all. I think he's more passionate. You know, I haven't spent time with him and been around him, and you know, I think he's more passionate. He's more dedicated than he's ever been. And, you know, he's never worn any of his Super Bowl rings in the past. So that's never been something that he's looked to as his trophy case. So I think he's always intrigued by the next game, the next event. And I think the team's in transition. And I think when you really boil this team down, you know, they struggle to score in the red area. They struggle to play red zone defense. They're very young on defense. And I think there's a combination of a lot of things, but I don't think it's the fastball being lost.
Well, let's look at the secondary. So my friends from back home who are saying that things should turn around or that this isn't Belichick's fault are pointing to the fact that we have bad defensive backs and they keep blowing coverages and all that stuff. But we won a Super Bowl with Troy Brown and Earthwind Moreland. So what's changed in the last 5 years? Like, you can't tell me Jonathan Wilhite and Darius Butler are worse than those guys.
They're not, and I think the reality of it is Earthwind Moreland didn't know where to go except somebody told him where to go. And, you know, now they don't have that guy on the field that tells everybody where to go, whether it's Rodney Harrison on level three, whether it's Bruschi on level two, you know. So, therefore, the lack of leadership, or the guy who can't really make all the calls, who really struggling to do his job, not alone help somebody else, is the reason why some of these players aren't in the right places and making mistakes. And I think oftentimes when you watch a football game, you see guys help other players. I mean, when we played in the Super Bowl in 2002, we had a tight end that didn't know where to go. Rich Gannon had to tell him every time where to line up. So, you know, that's just part of football. That happens all the time. And in the secondary right now, they don't have a guy that really can get everybody lined up. They've got guys who are talented and can play, but they lack some intangibles, if you will, that help them become better players.
Okay, so if that's a part of football, and Belichick obviously understands that because he won three Super Bowls, why then try it out a defense that doesn't have any of those guys?
Well, I think, you know, if you want to be critical of something, that certainly would be an area. I mean, you know, certainly why not try Darren Sharper? I think he's done a lot for the Saints secondary in terms of getting them lined up, being smart, showing them how to study and prepare. But there was such a movement in New England this offseason of getting faster, getting more athletic, getting able to make plays on defense that doesn't always lead you to a Darren Sharper. And I think we've learned something, and we all learn something every day. The Denver secondary, with their experience, has done a lot of good things, even though they're not the fastest team in the league. Even though they don't have the youthful players back there, they're still able to cover and cover well, and their experience makes up for their lack of athleticism.
All right, well, this leads me to the next point, because I'm not totally convinced that Belichick has lost his fastball either. I do think that this has not been his best season, and I would hope that he would even admit that. And I think this team has looked disjointed. I think the strategy at the end of the Colts game was an embarrassment. The Saints game, they got, you know, they're down 17-7. The game was over. Like, it was very un-Belichickian this entire season. Even Buffalo in week one, we should have lost that game. But you brought up that they didn't get any of these guys, and yet we both know that he knows that you need these guys. And then you tie in the Seymour trade. Did he go into this season thinking that this was a transition year? Because I'm starting to feel like he did. And I even wrote this after week three.
I think without a doubt, there is no question that this was a transition year. When he made the decision to get younger and more athletic on defense, you had to expect it was going to be a transition year. You can't maintain excellence. Now, I think where the fly in the ointment lies is the fact that the offense hasn't been able to carry these blurps in the road, if you will, as we go along on the defensive path. And that's been the main problem. The defense knew he was, they knew they were going to struggle, but they didn't anticipate that the offense was going to be struggling in the red zone. The offense wasn't going to be as consistent to be effective all year long. And I think that's really where the problem lies.
So maybe he's thinking going into the season, my offense is going to be good. I'm going to get 30, 35 points a game. The defense isn't going to be great anyway. It's a transition year for us. We're going to work in a lot of these young guys. I can trade Seymour because I'm going to get this great pick. And to be honest, it's not like he's going to turn us into the 85 Bears by being here or not being here. So I'm going to make that trade. And I'm just going to hope this season we outscore everybody. And hopefully this defense will come together. That's the logic?
I think that would be the logic. And I think that would be, as I looked at their team, and I evaluated them from afar, I thought that was the way they were going. And certainly, when you look at their numbers, you know, they're the second team in the league in offense. But the problem is they haven't been able to finish drives and score in the red zone, and that's really created problems for their defense because instead of having a 7-point lead, they have a 3-point lead, or they turn the ball over in the red area, and that heightens the problems that they were anticipating having on defense.
Well, and also, it's hard for me to believe he didn't see this coming before the year, but they don't have a running back that teams have to respect. And I know they signed Fred Taylor hoping he'd be that guy, but really, what were the odds that he was going to be healthy? He's as old as you are. Actually, that's an insult. You're younger than Fred Taylor. And then we don't have a third receiver. They hoped it was going to be Galloway. Bad signing. The tight end can't catch the ball without falling down. So,
right.
You know, I think the red zone, and then the other thing that, you know, I don't think people have been talking about enough, but, you know, I'm not Joe Football, but it does seem like teams are basically just leaving the middle of the field wide open and daring Brady to run with it, and he's just not going to do it. And the Saints were the one that came up. Gruden pointed it out. The Saints came up with that strategy, and now every team is doing it. And basically, Brady has to make the decision, I got to start running for these open lanes. He's just not doing it.
Right. When you play a team that plays a lot of man coverage, now what everybody's doing with them is they're playing a guy on Moss and a guy over top, and they're doubling Welker, whether he crosses the field or he goes vertically up the field. And it's called a two-trap. And even though which really what it does for Welker is it brings another tackler. That's what the Saints were able to do. They brought another tackler over when Welker caught the ball. And they almost doubled Falk on every play. And that puts the burden of the offense in Ben Watson's hands or Lawrence Maroney's hands or Sammy Morris's hands. And frankly, those guys haven't been able to come through. Now, you get teams out of play in these kind of coverages, exactly what you said. There's oftentimes you have to run the ball on third and five. If teams play man-to-man on you on third and five with two deep safeties, then the quarterback runs two or three times. They can't play that coverage anymore. And that's what's happened. And they know the same thing happens to Peyton Manning at times. They know he's not going to run with it so people can clamp down and play the coverage. The problem is Manning has been so precision-like with his accuracy that he gets the ball into tight spots anyway. Brady hasn't been that way this year, and he's had a couple times where guys haven't made plays when he's put the ball on them. Ben Watson, for example, down the seam, doesn't make a play that easily he should make.
And I've been watching Brady for this entire decade. And I think when you watch a football player or any athlete, after a while you become conditioned to the things that you think they're going to do because you've seen them so many times. And this year there's been at least 12 times when it seemed like I was conditioned to the thought of him tucking the ball and running because you watch it on TV and you're like, oh, look at that open space. He's going to – and then he wouldn't. And right. That makes me think that, you know, I know the ACL thing is a two-year injury. We got to stop pretending that football players can come back from this at 100% in a year because nobody's ever done it. And I also think he's banged up, and I think he has a real problem with their ribs that they're not being honest about. And I think he's got a problem with his finger, and I just think he's taking a beating this year.
And I would add one more thing, and I think this is something that the Patriots have to consider this offseason. I think they've run this offense so often, and people have looked at it and they've defended it in such a way that it may be time to go back to the drawing board this offseason and tweak it. And, you know, the worst thing that happens to you as an organization is when you lose a good coach, Josh McDaniels, you lose him. You would promote the next guy from within, and you think we can keep continuity and keep the same things, when oftentimes you'd be better off if you brought somebody fresh in with a fresh idea, a fresh approach, and kind of change some things and keep people on their toes a little bit. I think the Saints have proven that you need to be a little bit more two-back, you need to be diversified with your formations, keep people off balance, and change a little bit of what they do. And I think the Patriots, especially when they're in their spread, are able to be defended because people are comfortable knowing what they're going to run. And I think they have to change a little bit this offseason, and I think they got to go back to the drawing boards and come up with different ideas and different approaches, because the league very much catches up to you if you don't change. And you look at the Saints and you look at the Eagles this year, those two teams are labeled West Coast offenses, but they are so far from being a West Coast offense, it's ridiculous.
It's a pretty good point. I didn't even think of that. Yeah, you're right. The more years you run the same offense, people are eventually going to come up with some kryptonites for it.
Yeah, and that's what's happened. And then the burden falls on some of the players that are really role players that can't play the role. And, you know it in basketball. I mean, guys that play 18 minutes, they look good, but they go to some other team, they play 30, they're not as good.
Yeah.
And that's what's happened. And, and the burden falls on Ben Watson, it falls on Maroney, who look like they can be superstars when they're just really specific role players. But then when they have to be the man, they don't want to take the shot, and they can't make the shot.
The biggest thing that haunts this team is the fact that they went through the entire decade without ever getting a decent running back in the draft, which is almost impossible.
I find this interesting, and it must be, Bill's approach to running backs, because I found it interesting that Josh McDaniels' first act in his first draft as the head coach of the Denver Broncos was to draft a running back in the first round.
Yeah.
And, whereas typically, and I know they took Maroney in the first round, but typically the Patriots' mentality for running backs is we'll get somebody off the scrap heap and we'll make them better. And I agree. I think that mentality has really cost them some problems. And I do believe when you spread people out as much as they do, the back is more important than the receivers.
All right, this is embarrassing, but I'm going to compare this to video games. The easiest video game offense to run is the single back where you spread the receivers out because there's less people on the line and you can run a little bit more easily.
Right.
I would assume this translates into real life, but Maroney, it's not like the holes aren't there. He's going down with the first guy that's hitting him, basically. There's a couple times where he'll bowl people over, but for the most part, I watch guys like Ray Rice, and obviously Jones-Drew is the ideal, but these guys who can catch the ball on third down but also run, it's really the biggest advantage you can have in the NFL these days. Wait, these guys that make the defense not know what's going to happen on third down. Even like when you look at the Eagles, like McCoy is somebody that I think could potentially be like that. Like, these guys are out there every year. The Pats just can't find them.
Yeah, and sometimes you've got to find a guy. When you evaluate running backs, it's block, catch, and then run. And you have to have a guy who can pass protect if you're going to play him on third down specifically. But when you have the threat of the run on third and four, third and five, and teams are trying to play two-man on you, and they're trying to really clamp down on the two outside receivers, all you have to do is break one tackle, and it's a 50-yard gain. And that's what a great back can do for you. And I think if you put Chris Johnson on the Dallas Cowboys instead of Felix Jones, maybe Dallas wouldn't be having the problems they have today.
Oh, that's
interesting. If you put Chris Johnson on New England, they wouldn't clearly have the problems. And I think the back really makes the difference in your program, specifically when you're spreading people out.
And we've had a couple chances to get these guys and just haven't gotten them. And I think even this year, I like Knowshon Moreno. I mean, that's somebody they could have traded up for. Maybe you swap picks with the Raiders. They're going to get Hayward Bay at 23 anyway.
Knowshon is a guy that can run with it. He catches it well. Plus, he breaks tackles. And in the National Football League, Chris Johnson breaks more tackles than he gets credit for because that's how he gets long runs.
Yeah. All right. Enough about the Patriots. I'm boring the nation who doesn't care about them. What's today's date? December 14th?
16th.
December 16th. All right, we're right in the range of this is when somebody gets a ton of momentum heading toward the playoffs and you start kind of reconsidering all the preconceived notions you had about what might happen in the playoffs. San Diego is obviously the AFC team. Is Philly the NFC team?
Yeah, especially, and I read what you wrote this week about Andy Reid actually managing the game correctly and making all the right decisions. So, You know, if he does that, you know, they're going to be tough to beat. They're the only team that I've seen in the NFC that could go into Minnesota and win. They could go to New Orleans and win. They match New Orleans in terms of their speed of their offense and their mentality of their offense, because it's going to take a team to beat New Orleans that's going to want to score every time they have the ball on every possession. It's not going to take a team like Carolina who wants to, you know, get 20 points. Okay, let's go to four corners or stop scoring, or Miami can't execute in the fourth quarter. You know, it's going to take a team like that, like Philadelphia, that has the mentality, even if we score 30 in the first half, we need to try another 30 in the second half to win the game.
And you, I mean, this is the salient point. If you're going to win on the road in a tough place like the Superdome, the Metrodome, wherever, you need to be able to make big plays and make some stuff happen. And I think this DeSean Jackson, he's probably the number one playmaker from the receiver position. Would you agree?
It's remarkable. He's behind everybody. I said on the air the other night, he's like a center fielder. He's always the deepest guy. You know, and I don't understand how he gets so wide open. I mean,
I don't understand how he goes to the second round. Was it second round?
Yeah. Well, you know, he went in the second round because his time doesn't translate to his speed on the field, which is remarkable. But you know,
his 40 time.
Donovan McNabb doesn't get enough credit for throwing the ball down the field really well. He doesn't get enough credit for being an accurate down the field thrower. And as I said earlier, the Eagles are a West Coast offense. They're a down the field throwing team, and so that's the kind of team it's going to take to beat the Saints.
Were you surprised that they missed Westbrook this little?
No, not really, because Andy Reid, you know, it gives him an opportunity to call more passes. You know, that's all he's looking for. He wants to throw it up the field, and I give him credit. They've adapted to their team, and Westbrook was really not the same back he was in years past. And so now that allowed Leonard Weaver to come in and give him a big-time thumper to help him on those third and one calls and third and two calls that they struggled with in the past. So I think sometimes this injuries kind of helped clean up other players' roles on your team. And Westbrook being out certainly gave Leonard Weaver a bigger role that will help them as they go forward.
I love this. You know why I love this?
Why?
They're doing it to Philly fans again. They're doing it. They're sucking them in. Sucking them in. Making them think this year's different. How can you not be on to the Andy Reid, Donovan McNabb sucking in theory?
I mean, I think that they're now everybody says, well, they have holes on their defense, but you know, everybody has holes defensively. Even Minnesota has holes defensively. The National Football League is about you got to outscore people with your passing game. That's how you're going to do it. And all this notion, you're going to hear it on certain channels on pregame shows. You got to run the ball to win the game today. That's just nobody's paying attention to the game if you think you can run the ball and win in this league.
You know those bad movies where like the white trash husband comes home, he's not drinking anymore, and he moves back in with his wife who lives with her parents, and the parents are like, he's going to hurt you again. He's going to hurt you. And the wife said, no, he's different. He's not drinking anymore. You got a job. And then like 2 weeks later, he's in some sort of car accident outside a bar. This is the Andy Reid, Donovan McNabb era with the Eagles. They keep roping you back in, and the Philly fans are the wife. And they're saying, oh, no, it's different. It's different. He's not drinking anymore.
I think this tale is belongs in Minneapolis. This tale, this movie that you're describing.
Oh, it's the same movie. Favre Childress. Oh, no, it's different.
I think it's playing in Minneapolis. You think it's playing in both cities. I don't disagree.
I think it's a double feature.
For sure.
I think it's a double feature. And you know what else? I think it's also running in San Diego. Phil Rivers, North Turner.
Well. Phil Rivers hasn't lost a game in December in his career. Can you imagine this?
I know. I actually
Ended in Indianapolis and won the game. I mean, you know, and they played New England with Philip Rivers on a torn ACL. So, I mean, you got to cut him a little slack.
No, I do. I like Phil Rivers. I was just lashing out. I do think that North Turner could be the Doc Rivers of the NFL, where somebody who just had a pattern of incompetence and got enough reps, coached for enough years, was surrounded by enough talent that eventually the good things about his ability began to surface, and they found ways to cover up the things that he's not as good at, and now he's a good coach.
Yeah, and I think the fact that he's one of the best play callers in the league.
Yes.
Maybe second to Sean Payton. And the fact that the quarterback, who really is the guy who's running this team, it's not LT's team anymore, it believes in him. And so when you have that kind of faith in your coach – You know, in Washington, he didn't have that. You know, in Oakland with us, he didn't have that. He had no quarterback that really believed in him. And Phillip Rivers believes in North, and that makes the team believe in him. And, you know, when if he was in Dallas, I think the same things would have happened had they hired him for Tony Romo as opposed to Wade, because Tony Romo would have believed in North, and then that would have helped the team. I think there's two ways to get to motivate your team. If the quarterback's the leader of the team, that's the greatest way to go forward. But if he's not, it's very difficult. Then the head coach has got to take a lot of the burden on himself to get the team. Sean Payton, actually, when I watch Drew Brees, I'm not sure it's not Sean Payton playing quarterback at times, because they just seem like one person.
And, you know, back to video games, I judge all of the offenses that I watch by, you know, you recognize plays that you ran once upon a time, or like, there's just a level of imagination that you only see with a couple teams. And for me this year, those teams are the Saints and the Chargers. Like, for instance, the Chargers run this play every freaking game. It's the same play, and the team, it always works, and the defense always fools them. They pretend they're running, like, not totally a sweep, but like, what's the off tackle, the pseudo sweep, whatever that's called?
Yeah.
What's that called?
The stretch play away?
Yeah, the stretch play away. So they feed that to the right. The whole defense shifts to the right side. And then they send that tight end on the right side. He comes over to the left side. He sneaks over. And the whole field is wide open. And it works every freaking game.
The tight end. Yeah, and typically
every game it works.
And they always run it. Now they're starting to run it in their own territory. But it was always an alert whenever they cross midfield to alert the tight end throwback. And you know, and New Orleans does the same play. New Orleans has a couple variations of it. New Orleans is so creative how they move their tight end around, and then they have that flow screen. So, yeah, there's so many great ideas going out there, but they execute. It all comes down to the ability to execute. I mean, when you look at Cleveland, they're trying to run the throwback screen, too. They just can't execute it.
They're throwing it off the guy's face. Yeah, I thought the Pats-Saints game, I've been up and down on the Monday Night Football team this year because I do think they fall into the trap of this guy's great, what a great play, awesome play there. But I thought they did it.
Gruden is the Will Rogers of announcing. He loves everybody.
He loves everybody.
I've been in a room with Gruden, and trust me, he doesn't love everybody. You know, but on TV, he loves everybody.
Well, but in that Saints-Pats game, I thought they did an incredible job. And they had the cameras, too, because the Superdome, you could put some cool cameras in there. But they did a great job of breaking down exactly the type of plays that the Saints were doing and those little double wide receiver hitches. It was amazing. Sean Payton, to me, is now the number one offensive guy.
Yeah, he has a down cold. And again, he's got people thinking that they're a West Coast offense, and you've got to play the underneath. And really, they run crossing patterns or they run seams. And then they're the best screen team. And, you know, this week against Atlanta, they took the screen that they run, Reggie Bush runs in the end zone untouched, was the same screen that the San Diego Chargers ran against Atlanta in a preseason game. So that shows you the depth of the research. You know, the same blitz caught them. Payton had the same check that Norv had in the preseason game and walked in the end zone. So, yeah. And all these teams we're talking about are all great screen teams, which you have to be a great screen team in the National Football League to be able to withstand in the playoffs, because you need some easy throws and you got to shut down the pass rush and you need to make them think about slowing up a little bit. Screens are vital to that, and that's why the teams that throw the ball effectively that are good screen teams are really even more dangerous, because they're like big runs.
You know what's incredible about the Saints and the fact that they're undefeated? When you think that what they could be getting out of Reggie Bush versus what they're actually getting, like, imagine if Reggie Bush was Chris Johnson. Because when he was coming into the pros, all of us thought he was going to be this guy that, you know, was five special teams a year. Yeah, but imagine if he was 87% of what we thought he was going to be, and you put him on this specific team, it would be the greatest offense of all time.
Right, but the reality they are the best offense that they've ever been since Sean's been there is because they realize Reggie Bush isn't those things. So they're not trying to feed the monster. They're not trying to make Reggie Bush into something he's not. And that's why they're so effective. They're running an offense now. They're just not running plays for Reggie Bush, which makes them better. It's the same thing that happened in Washington when Sherm Lewis came out of the bingo parlor and he tried to run the offense around Clinton Portis. He tried to feed that monster. Clinton Portis unfortunately got hurt, which was fortunate for the Redskin offense, because now they no longer had to worry about running plays for him. They could just run the West Coast offense, and they've seen it to run fairly effectively. So, you know, that really, when you identify what a player can do and can't do and you try to stop feeding what I call feeding the monster, you become better. And that's what happened with Bush. And I've said this to Sean Payton. You know, you're a better team now because you realize Bush isn't your main guy.
San Diego can go into Indianapolis and beat them.
Yeah, they can.
I think that's the only team in the AFC that can go in there and win, personally.
Yeah, and I will say this. Denver, I mean, Indianapolis on defense is much faster than people give them credit for. They're particularly fast, especially in the red area where, like, and I try to compare this to the Syracuse zone when they had Carmelo Anthony and Hakeem Warwick. They had those long arm players playing that 2-3 zone, and they were long and quick. And so it really was like a 3-3 zone because of the length of the players and the quickness. That really the only way you're going to score on the Colts is to be proficient in the red area, which I think the Chargers can be. And two, I think you have to have a great plan. And I would practice, actually, 12 guys on the field if I was playing the Colts because that's how quick they are on defense.
Wow. I like the 12 guys on the field strategy. So,
yeah,
so nobody else can go in Indianapolis and beat them if they're healthy, in your opinion?
I don't see it. I mean, Cincinnati to me is a paper tiger. They might rally for a game or two, but they're not going to beat anybody of substance. They can't throw the ball well enough. I mean, all the Cedric Benson talk about him running the ball, which I think Cedric's been much better than I ever thought he possibly could be, but running games bore me to death, and they don't win in the playoffs. Just ask the Atlanta Falcons from last year. And New England, I think, certainly has the kind of toughness of a team. I just don't think they're talented enough to go into Indy and beat them again. Although, you know, hey, we're sitting here killing them, but they had the 21, they had the big lead at the half, and they turned the ball over.
I know. It was the best game of the year, and it lasted three quarters.
Yeah. So, I to me, it's San Diego. It's going to take somebody that can handle the speed of their defense in the red area.
NFC, who can... I'm not saying it will happen, but who can go into the Superdome and beat that team?
I think Green Bay could do it. Green Bay can score and they can throw it. Now, Green Bay obviously can't protect their passer, but the way Green Bay's playing on defense, again, another injury. You know, Aaron Kampen's a really good player in a 4-3 defense. He's not a good player in a 34, but that injury helped Green Bay in this sense. It defined who they were. And they could put Brad Jones in at linebacker, and they could quit trying to work around Aaron Kampen, and they could just play their defense. It really helped them.
You know what it was like? You know what it was like? It was like when they broke the goalie's arm in victory and Sly Stallone moved in. I don't think they beat the Nazis otherwise. I hadn't made a sports movie reference all podcast.
Yeah, there you go. And so I think that's really the reality. I think, you know, the Packers have the kind of team that can do that. I think the Eagles can go down there. It's going to take teams that can score and have a scoring mentality. That's the key. It's the scoring mentality. And the Eagles, they just keep trying to score. And ultimately, that's what to beat the Saints, you know, there's no lead safe.
NFC odds right now. The Saints are -140. In other words, you have to bet $140 on them to win 100. The Vikings are +175. Now, the Cardinals, +600. The Eagles, +700. The Packers, +1,500. And Dallas, +2,000. So basically, Packers, 15-1 to win the NFC. You're saying that's not a terrible bet.
I don't think it's a bad bet. I haven't thought the Packers were a bad bet all year. I mean, I know they struggled defensively early in the season, but I haven't thought so. It's going to be a tough challenge to go into Minnesota and win and go down to New Orleans and win 14. And clearly, Green Bay wasn't able to win in Minnesota once. But I think a team that plays the Saints, the team that beats the Saints, is going to have to know how to play the Saints. Because you're not going to play the Saints like New England did and not get used to their speed. They're too fast for you to really understand how to play them.
San Diego is 3-1 to win the AFC. Colts are -150. Bengals are +450. That's got to be the worst bet on the board. Please don't do that, anyone who's listening. Pats are +700. And the Titans are +7,000. Seems a little high.
If they can get in, they could be dangerous. The problem is they just dug too deep of a hole. They're a dangerous team.
But somebody's got to be the sixth wild card. I mean, the second wild card.
It's going to be Baltimore because of the schedule. Baltimore's got such a favorable schedule that they can walk in.
I don't trust Flacco.
I don't either. But after the Green Bay game, they came home on that team plane early in the morning and said, you know what, Flacco's not good enough for us to carry. We need to get back to who we are. Plus, they have the Bears this week. They play Oakland in the last game. You don't think the Raiders will have all their bags packed?
Oh, my God. I don't even know. Are you quarterbacking them this week? Who's the quarterback this
Uncle
week?
Uncle Charlie Fry.
Is that really who it is?
That's who's going to be Uncle Charlie Fry.
Well, Cable Charlie Fry.
Uncle Charlie's going to take him in. Cable has to win two of the three to get there.
So
he's, you know, the Jamarcus experiment's not going to start until next year again.
Experiment. Is that what we're calling it now? Baltimore, follow up your point. Baltimore goes home Chicago, at Pittsburgh, at Oakland. I'm sorry, but if you're telling me that Baltimore can't blow that Oakland game, I don't believe you. And they can also easily blow that Pittsburgh game. I'm not penciling them in for anything.
Pittsburgh right now can't, you know, right now they've got too much dissension going on with their team. The guys have checked out, and, you know, Hines Ward's playing with injured. Hines Ward was slow before the hamstring, and he tried to play with the hamstring. It's the best thing he could ever do to help the Browns win the game. He ran about 5-5 on the tape.
Where is Mike Tomlin during all this?
I think Mike Tomlin is trying to figure it all out. I think poor Mike has kind of got caught in this whirlwind of the disease of me. You know, it's those guys, everybody wants credit now. You know, and it's going to take an off season to clean this mess up.
Well, Miami's 7-6. So is Jacksonville. So is Baltimore. So are the Jets. Pittsburgh 6-7. Houston 6-7.
If we let
Tennessee
Jacksonville in, they're one and done too.
I think we all need to band together and prevent that from happening somehow. If that means we have to pay for the team, for the opposing fans to go to that half-empty stadium and root for the other team, then let's all do it. Because if you're telling me that on round one I have to sit through a Cincinnati-Jacksonville game, I can't accept that.
Yeah, you're going to flip the channel and you're going to watch I Love Lucy.
I watched this rough cut of a 30 for 30 that we're doing about Ricky Williams that I don't want to give away, but has the potential to be truly amazing, and it made me reconsider every notion I had about this guy, and it also made me root for him, and it made me realize that, are we making enough of this story that this guy was out and now is probably one of the best 10 running backs in the league again? This guy was out of the league and done.
I think he was overblown as a young guy coming out of Texas, and I think he's underhandled now because he's really much better than he ever was coming out of college. I was wrong on him. Now, he fumbled last week, which he's always had fumbleitis, but now he's just running harder. He looks faster. Whatever he was doing on his sabbatical, we all need to do some of it because he looks younger and faster and more athletic than he's ever been.
Well, there's no way we can air this documentary, unfortunately, before the season ends because it's just not ready yet. But I was just blown away by, first of all, how many – he's had like 5 drug suspensions, which you forget. It's like, oh, yeah, he's been suspended for drugs. But you forget it was like 5 times. You forget the part where he played for the Toronto Argonauts. He missed 2 full seasons.
He was up there doing that.
Mike Lombardi, thanks for being on the BS Report.
So you're the best. Thanks, buddy. I appreciate it.
I'm going to keep talking as Joe Mead calls Jacko because we're calling Jacko for his take on the on all the baseball stuff. I did want to mention that Mike Lombardi, you can read on nationalfootballpost.com. I read him every day. He's also on Twitter. And he should be on the BS Report more often. He had to run because he's taping inside the NFL doing TV for us. Here's Jacko.
Complex Litigation, this is John.
Oh, Johnny!
Oh, an excited Bill Simmons. What's up, Willie?
You don't want this!
Did you get your lackey jersey yet, or are you saving up for the Cameron one?
I'm all about Mike Cameron. Anytime you could pay $8 million a year for a 36-year-old outfielder who strikes out 150 times, you got to do it. You got to do it.
Absolutely.
We need to improve our defense at left field because, you know, left field at Fenway, you need a guy with a lot of range.
Yeah, really.
It's a great signing. I'm so fired up.
Well, you know, he was a steroid guy, so it's someone for Big Poppy to talk about protein shakes with, so that's good.
I didn't like a single thing about that signing. I can understand if he's going to play center, if you're like, listen, we're going to trade Jacoby Ellsbury, and this is going to be our new center fielder.
Well, maybe they're
like,
still going
to
do
that. Well, then I'll reconsider. But for right now, if you're telling me that we've signed this guy to play left field, and 81 of those games are Fenway Park, and we signed him for defense. I mean, freaking Yaz could play left field in 1983 at age 40, living a cigarette out of his mouth. I don't think we need an athlete for left field, guys.
That's a fair point, yeah. No, Manny didn't really cover a lot of range out there either and was capable at Fenway, so.
You and I could learn how to play the wall. You turn around, you see where it's going to ricochet, and then you throw the ball to second base.
It's
not rocket science.
Right, exactly.
I was not crazy about that signing.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I mean, he was rumored to go to the Yankees last year, That was a big rumor that Cashman had a crush on Mike Cameron for some reason. And then he was rumored as a possible replacement for Damon this year. And both last year and this year, I recoiled from the prospect of Mike Cameron. I was like, ooh, Mike Cameron, not a huge fan. So I can't really say that scared me too much when he signed with the Red Sox.
I know what they're doing. They're doing, you know, they're going to build everything around pitching and defense.
Right, exactly.
Which is fine. And I'm sure we'll win 95 games again. Am I going to be excited to watch these games? I'm not sure.
Probably, yeah, really. Pitching and defense in the American League, is, you know, you'll be biting your fingernails occasionally. A lot of 2-1 games. I don't know if they have enough offense right now.
We don't. We don't have nearly enough offense.
You didn't have enough offense last year.
No.
And now you don't have Jason Bay, who had 36 and 119, a huge percentage of that offense. Big Poppy's a year older. I don't know what's up with Mike Lowell, if he's going to be there or not be there. But I think you've downgraded the offense here, and you're counting on pitching and defense. And I don't know if that's going to work in the American League.
We downgraded an offense that I already didn't like.
It was already lacking, exactly.
Lacking,
yes. I wasn't even trying that, but lacking, yes.
I just picture myself talking myself into this team, and then like about a weekend, they'll be going to a break with the Red Sox coming up, and Don Arcillo saying, coming up, Cameron, Scudero, and Ellsbury. And I'm going to be like, oh, my God.
Yeah, the team still has no personality either, like no juice, no exciting guy. They really miss Manny for the antics and the offense. They're really a letdown.
It's whatever. I guess we're going the pitch and defense pitch count route. And I'm sure statistically there's a lot of solid arguments for this. But
sure.
Of course I have to watch this team for 160 games. Just give me one guy I'm excited about. Just anybody. Like even, you know, John Lackey. It's like, yeah, you're not telling your grandkids that John Lackey's coming into town?
No,
that was a great
it.
Signing. But, you know, for considering that they basically paid him A.J. Burnett money. And
yeah, he's better than
A.J. Burnett,
right.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, now, he's not like, I don't know, John Lackey doesn't put the fear of God into me. I was talking to a buddy of mine at work who's a Yankees fan, and I said, you know, when the Yankees, I think I mentioned this on a podcast, when the Yankees played the Angels in the ALCS last year, I'm like, you know, John Lackey, you know, he's not like he was their number one guy, but I'm not like, oh my God, John Lackey, what are we going to do? You know, that doesn't really bother me. And
but
the Sox had a good rotation last year, and they have a good rotation this year. I mean, they've got probably the best rotation in baseball.
But if he's your third starter.
Oh, yeah.
That's really good.
Oh, definitely. He's going to win a lot of games going up against some other team's number three, definitely.
Yeah.
And he's better. I mean, he's better than A.J. Burnett for the same money, basically. So, that, yeah, that's a good deal for them.
He is injury prone,
though, but so is A.J. Burnett. So.
I've talked myself into it, and I don't know if it's because I'm a homer or not. But the one thing that does worry me is that I do know a few Angels fans out here.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them were like, good luck, you overpaid. And not like Angels fans aren't like Yankee fans where they're just trying to start stuff. Like,
right.
Ultimately, they're just not wired that way. And all of them were excited that the Angels didn't overpay for this guy, which makes me nervous. It's like when you buy the car from somebody else and you're driving the car that you just bought from somebody's house, and the neighbor's like, hey, good luck.
Yeah, exactly.
And it has a big smile on his face. You're like, hey, what's wrong with the car? Why is that guy looking at it like that?
Right, because every weekend he's seen the guy out there with the hood up trying to replace something. Right?
Yeah, or he's seen it sputtering, trying to start in the morning in 20 degrees. So,
he does have a bad record at Fenway, too, but you can't put – I mean, he was pitching against the Red Sox. You can't give that a huge amount of credence, but it is interesting. It's an interesting side note.
It also makes me – I'm intrigued that after years and years of Theo preaching this whole – if we're going to spend big money on guys, we want to get guys that are entering that 28, 29 age range and entering their prime. We don't want to fall into the habit of paying guys after their prime. And then we spend $85 million on a guy who turns 32 next year.
Yeah, I mean, that, when he's 37, the fifth year of that contract, they'll be doing what they're doing with Lowell. They'll trade him to somebody and pay 75% of his contract.
Do you think Theo knows that you can have a season where you're not paying $50 million worth of dead contracts?
I heard something the other day if the Lowell thing goes through and they pay $9 million of his contract and they're still paying Lugo, that the Red Sox are the only team that's paying for two left sides of the infield, theirs and someone else's.
I didn't get the Mike Lowell trade at all. Like, if you're saving $3 million,
yeah,
why not just keep him?
I don't get that. I understand that he's, you know, you could see he's still capable at third, and I realize he has only one hip and ran like my late grandfather, but, I mean, if you're going to pay $9 million out of $12 million, you might as well have him hang around, be a good clubhouse guy and DH occasionally or something. No? I mean, Is there really somebody that's banging down the door that much that needs that roster spot? Adrian Beltre?
You're saving $3 million so that you can then overpay other players. Like, that's the part I don't get.
I didn't understand that. And to get this Max Ramirez or whatever, who apparently is like an awful catcher, and that's his position. So it's like, he's not like the second coming of Johnny Bench or something. I don't understand the need to make that trade.
Yeah, if you're going to spend $160 million, it's the equivalent of like, you know, Kimmel bought this Hollywood Hills house. It's really nice. And if we try to get the football game, it's like, yeah, I didn't pay for the package. I didn't really get it. Like, if you're going to buy the house, you got to go all out.
Right. You might as well upgrade, yeah.
You can't say, like, oh, I got to skimp on this $3 million on Mike Lowell, who was a great clubhouse guy for them. It was the 2007 World Series MVP. And why should I have to watch him on another team if it saves you $3 million?
You're going to go buy a Porsche, but don't get a stereo put in. I don't need the stereo in it, you know?
I'm also not convinced that he's done.
Yeah, he put up good offensive numbers last year. He had 75 RBIs. He had like 20 home runs,
see,
didn't
that, he? The baseball stat nerds, you threw out an RBI stat. You're not allowed to do that anymore.
I'm sorry.
That's not.
I don't buy
into RBI are chance. It's chance.
I don't buy into all that, you know, sabermetric stuff, though. I'm not a huge fan of that. I'm old school, you know?
Well, that's going to be a problem for some people out there.
I understand. I want some old overweight scout, just like half an alcoholic with tobacco stains on his shirt, not on a cigar. That's who I want picking players for me. I don't want some guy with a laptop, you know, an MBA. Give me a break.
You should root for the Mets, because I think that's how Omar Minaya does it.
look how well that's worked out.
I want to look up Lowell's stats last year, because I really don't think they were that good. Here we go.
25 home runs, right?
No, it was 17.
Oh, I don't know where I got 25 from.
337 on base and 474 slugging, 811 OPS.
Mm.
Fielding, not the same kind of range, but still a nice glove. Or not any range.
I was going to say, not any range.
Only 445 at-bats, so 17 homers. I mean, it wasn't a colossal fall off the cliff by any means.
No, I don't think it was terrible.
He's not somebody you pay to play for another team.
At the end of the year, people were clamoring for him, or when Big Poppy went in a slump, people were clamoring, after they got Adrian Gonzalez, people were clamoring to sit down Big Poppy and put in Lowell as the DH. They still wanted him in there. I remember reading that in the Boston Globe.
Yeah, I mean, you could make a much better case that maybe the guy you'd want to pay off is Big Poppy, because he's a DH.
Yeah, but I don't think you can ship him anywhere.
Probably not.
He's clogging up the DH hole, and there's no, I mean, where's he going to play? At least Lowell, you could run out at third base if you were, you know, moving guys around. He at least can play the infield.
I don't like the concept of paying anybody to play for somebody else. Like, the Julio Lugo thing bothered me last year.
And they did it previously with Renteria. They're the kings of doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, the Yankees get killed for an enormous payroll, and justifiably, but, I mean, the Red Sox have a huge payroll, and then they pay a lot of other players just to stay away.
Yeah.
Well, they have some financial means as well. Let's not kid ourselves.
I'm not going to give a final report card yet because
they
have a couple moves left.
If they go make a trade for Adrian Gonzalez, this is likely since Jed Hoyer was their assistant GM. He's probably still on the Red Sox payroll, and Selig will facilitate Adrian Gonzalez going to the Red Sox for 25 cents on the dollar. I mean, then that's huge for them.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll believe it when he does it in the American League, but that would be huge for them. And that makes no sense for San Diego. The guy makes, like, comparatively about $20 a year. He's wildly popular out there. You're going to trade him for, like, Clay Buchholz and Ellsbury?
I'm not sure anything makes sense of baseball anymore because somehow the Mariners got Cliff Lee.
I know. I
examined
that
trade from every angle, and I know, because I'm in that stupid AL Keeper League, I know who all the good prospects are, and I don't know how they got Cliff Lee. It makes no sense. I've looked at it I've read every column about it. I've looked at it from 40 angles, and this is an absolute farce that this guy ended up on the Mariners for basically not a lot.
I mean, there's been a switch in powers in the AL West. The Angels have done nothing except signing an over the hill Hideki Matsui, but they let their number one starter go, and they let Sean Figgins go, and the Mariners now are going to run out Felix Hernandez and Cliff Lee. That's a pretty good one, too.
Yeah.
That's and a really good one, too.
And the Rangers are going to have Justin Smoke this year. And, I don't know if we – Josh Hamilton was so bad last year. I don't know whether that was an aberration or that was the 4 months in 2008 just one of the biggest sports flukes ever or what happened. But you assume he's going to be better this year, too.
I think it would be a bounce back year. He was a little hurt. Wasn't he hurt last year? He had a couple injuries.
He was banged up. Yeah. I do think – I agree there's going to be a change in the guard. Let's talk about the Yanks.
All right.
Curtis Granderson. Anytime you can get a leadoff hitter who has a .310 on base percentage, you got to do it.
He's a guy that hits .249 and strikes out 141 times a year.
Yeah.
I know. When I first heard about it, I'm like, I didn't understand the fascination with Curtis Granderson. But then the more I read about it, I kind of talked myself into it. Now, I've only talked myself into it if they re-sign Johnny Damon. If they don't re-sign Johnny Damon, I think it's disastrous. And I don't understand the fascination with Granderson. I mean, to an extent, I do, because he hit 30 home runs last year, and he's left-handed, and he only hit 10 at Comerica, so he hit a lot on the road, and the short porch in right field of Yankee Stadium, you figure, is going to be very good for him. Now, he's another guy that's going to, a better range guy, but really, is he that much of an upgrade over Melky Cabrera in center field? I mean, really? Numbers-wise, Melky had a higher average. I realize that Granderson hit 30 home runs, but... he doesn't steal that many bases either. And defensively last year, he had a couple of big, odd defensive plays where he dropped the ball.
Mm.
Now, maybe I was thinking, well, maybe you just chalk it up to lack of interest in Detroit. But Detroit was good last year. They went to a one-game playoff. They, almost won the Central. So if he was disinterested there, now he's suddenly going to be interested for the Yankees. But then I read about him, and he's apparently, the best clubhouse guy ever.
He's in the top five all time. Yeah, Gammons, I think, it just turns into a puddle if his name's brought up.
I know. I'm wondering, what is he doing? Magic tricks in the clubhouse or something? Or, balloon animals for players' kids? People were just, raving about him, how great he was as a guy. And he's younger. They did get younger, which is good. And, he has some upside, as they would say in the NBA draft. So I kind of talked myself into it after a while, but I'm a little concerned about the Yankees' direction in terms of I realized Matsui was over the hill, and I was never a huge Matsui fan. So, yeah, I thank you for Game 6, Hideki, and good luck on the West Coast. But I really want Johnny Damon to come back as a left fielder / DH.
You'll get him. It'll happen.
I don't know. I keep reading all these quotes about how they're far apart, and I don't want him to get his nose out of the joint, although I don't know where – I think he would, all things being equal, would like to come back to New York.
What's going to happen when Granderson and Swisher are in the same clubhouse? I feel like we can heal cancer between those two. Just put different vaccines in there, and they can figure it out.
This radiating glow of the two of them just talking in the clubhouse. People just come out beaming,
It's can the Yankees play some exhibition games in Africa and see if they can heal malaria?
Right. It's true. The two, best clubhouse guys ever. I'm not sure what they're capable of.
I actually – I'm ashamed to admit this, but I like the Granderson trade for two of the reasons that you already mentioned. The home away, homer stats. I just think that – ballpark that he was in is
it's a cavernous.
Switch that first him with the short right field porch. It's going to be a dramatic difference. Awesome guy. The one thing I would worry about is that he really sucked down the stretch.
Yeah, the 141 strikeouts. I mean, I worry about when the trade first happened. I worried about the future of my remote control for my TV because I could see a big situation where he comes up and whiffs, and I hurl it against the wall while screaming expletives. So I don't like guys that strike out. That drives me nuts. Just make contact, put the ball in play, do something with it. But strikeouts kill me. And you worry that now he's trying to be a home run hitter, and especially with the short right field porch, sometimes that can screw guys' swings up because they're trying to swing for the fences on everything. Mm. But I like the fact they got younger. I think he has some, some upside. I've talked myself into it, but I really want Johnny Damon back.
You love Johnny Damon.
I do.
Literally, you might be attracted to him.
I feel a little funny when I see him on TV, I'll be honest with you. But he was in the midst of every offensive rally they had last year. In the World Series, he made the single greatest play I've seen in 33 years of watching baseball when he took the unattended third base. And I just think that he's a huge catalyst for them offensively. And I like the Granderson trade a lot better if Granderson is batting seventh or eighth rather than having to bat second.
I agree.
So
Johnny will come back.
If they have a lineup with Damon back in it in a limited role, and I realize that Damon plays left field about as well as I do in company softball games, but I want his bat. I don't care about his defense. And you can mix and match, and maybe he can DH, and you can play around with the outfield a little bit so he doesn't have to be out there that much. But I just think his swing is tailor-made for Yankee Stadium. and they really need his offense. And a lineup with where you're running out Granderson batting like seventh or eighth, and the other guys they have, I mean, that's a pretty good lineup. I'll take my chances with that.
It's pretty good. I also, the other part is Austin Jackson.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we felt like he was a bigger prospect than he was.
Right.
Because the Yankees and Red Sox are always mentioned in trade rumors, so you hear this guy's name constantly.
All the time,
and it makes you think
years.
That
right.
he's a bigger prospect than he is, and he's not. I mean,
right.
It's like, that's not, Austin Jackson wasn't making or breaking the next decade for the Yankees.
Well, that was the thing that when I first heard about the trade, I'm like, really, Austin Jackson? Like, they gave up that much for Curtis Granderson? Because he's, like you say, he'd been so highly touted for like the last 5 years.
But he wasn't. It
and
was
they
just, he was,
you know,
highly mentioned.
They claimed he was untouchable and they wouldn't include him in a Santana trade, or he was always mentioned in rumors when, you know, Halliday was in the mix. But, then you look and you see he only hit 4 home runs in AAA, and I read all these things about how they thought that he regressed, and you know, they didn't really have big hopes for him, that his ceiling is to someday be Curtis Granderson, maybe, but Curtis Granderson already is Curtis Granderson, so you take your chances on that.
Yeah.
So I was okay with it.
They did a nice job of hoodwinking the Tigers on him. I still want to know how the Mariners got Cliff Lee.
Well, that trade is a head-scratcher, because when I first saw the thing on the crawl on the bottom of ESPN the other night, and it said Phillies to get Halliday, I'm like, oh my god, Halliday, and then it says they're, and then they talk about who they give up, and I'm like, well, they're giving up Cliff Lee, like, what's the point of that trade? They
yeah.
basically traded Cliff Lee for Halliday. I'm like, well, it's one thing if they have Halliday and Lee, they're a juggernaut in the National League, but they basically traded one guy who was already proven to be great for them for another guy who in all likelihood will be great, but you don't have two great guys together.
With all that said, Roy Halladay could challenge Bob Gibson's 1968 season National
League. Oh, yeah, there's no question. I mean, he could knock on the door of 30 wins. There's no doubt. Absolutely.
He's going to be like, wow, this is great. I wish I had done this 5 years ago.
Oh, I know. Yeah, definitely. He's out of the American League East. Doesn't have to face the Yankees and the Red Sox, you know, 19 games each for the year. Not that he pitches 19 times, but,
yeah,
you know, there's the possibility of facing them numerous times. So, yeah, he's going to feast on the National League.
His ERA will be... It was like 3 last year. I think it's going to be 5 runs lower than that. I think his ERA is going to be -2.
Oh, yeah.
First time ever.
He's going to be fantastic. There's no question. And he signed for pretty low money for what he could have done on the open market. And that's, I guess, why the Phillies did it, because Cliff Lee wanted Sebastian money. The Phillies were like, good luck.
Good luck, Cliff.
Good luck at future.
You almost had a baseball 3 years ago.
Exactly. You lost 25 games or whatever. So, yeah, good luck to you, Cliff.
I'm looking at Austin Jackson's stats on Baseball Cube.
Yes. I know he had 4 home runs in AAA. I remember reading that at the time of the trade.
Yeah, last year he was at Scranton, AAA.
Scranton, yes.
300 average, 354 on base, 405 slugging, 24 steals, 4 caught, 4 homers, 123 strikeouts. Sounds like a winner, Detroit. Good luck.
Yeah, 123 strikeouts in AAA. That's a little hefty.
And he's going to be 23 next season. So it
he's
sounds
young.
Like best case scenario, a slower Jacoby Ellsbury. Good luck.
Yeah.
Hope that works out for you.
Enjoy.
Why were they so anxious to get rid of Curtis Granderson and Edward Jackson? That's the other thing I don't get.
Well, I figured it was a money thing. But Granderson really doesn't make huge money. But I think, it's Detroit. It's like the most depressed city in America.
I liked Edward Jackson.
It was probably a money thing.
You know,
although the guy that owns them, doesn't he own Domino's Pizza? He must still be doing all right, doesn't he?
Mike Ilitch?
Yeah. I think he still owns them, right?
Edwin Jackson was on my AL keeper team that I think Hench and I are abandoning this winter.
The thing I'm worried about is Jim Leland. When they traded Edwin Jackson and Curtis Granderson, he might go up to like 3 cartons a day.
Yeah, he just eats cigarettes now. He doesn't even smoke them.
They might have to put a couple nicotine patches on him, and he's still going to smoke a carton of cigarettes.
Quickly, because we got to go in like 5 minutes.
Sure.
The Jersey Shore. How has it altered your life?
I'm not sure I can sum up all of my emotions in 5 minutes. It's so good. Oh, my God. It's so good. It's indescribable how good it is.
It's a phenomenon. It's caught on. It's an American phenomenon. I was watching Jimmy Kimmel show last night, and he worked in the Jersey Shore, 3 of the cast members. They did like a Christmas thing.
Who did?
The 3 of the Jersey Shore cast members. They did the story of Jesus. They were dressed up.
God.
It's fantastic.
It's phenomenal, and it's more phenomenal for me on a personal level because, as you all know, you and I spent a week on the Jersey Shore in 1993.
Yeah, a weekend.
This really captures it. It really encapsulates everything, and they're just such a prime example of the Jersey Shore, and everything they do and say is like quotable. I mean, it's just fantastic. They're you know, you always talk about the unintentional comedy and self-awareness. I mean, they're completely, they have no self-awareness whatsoever because they think everything they do is just completely cool. And it's done, everything they do is done unironically. Like, they really believe, like, this is, like, the way to be.
Yeah.
When the guy was packing up to leave for the Jersey Shore and he literally collected 25 bottles of hair gel for a one-month trip to the Jersey Shore, I mean, how fantastic was that? You can't make it up.
No.
You couldn't write that in a script.
Well, did you watch the Jersey Show after show?
You know, I didn't. I actually have been DVRing the Jersey Shore.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize there was a Jersey Shore after show until last week when I was fast-forwarding through the commercials. And then I said, wait a second, what's that? And they were showing previews of the after the show or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was so bummed out that I had missed it. I literally, like, wanted to question my existence. I don't know if I can go on. I didn't know. I didn't DVR this part.
It revealed that Angelina,
the one who left,
and the situation.
Ah.
Had a little romantic history well before the show.
Oh, before. Really?
That was the real reason she left.
It was a pre-existing situation?
It was a situation.
That's the situation. Oh, that's interesting. I really think,
you know, I can only judge this from conversations I've had with my friends and emails and everything, but I don't think anyone is getting enough of the situation.
You know, the situation is among my friends, the situation is the most popular one. I personally, I like Snooki. I mean, I just think she's just fantastic in a humorous way. And I like the guy that brought the 25 bottles of hair gel, I'm not going to lie to you, and all the tattoos.
Pauly D.
I like Pauly D's haircut. I like his gel. I like everything about him. I like the tats. Yeah, he's really the king. The situation gets all the hype, and I can see why, because he's, you know, he's the situation. I completely get it, but it's really, you know, it's hard to choose, I think.
I think you've overthought this whole thing, and you're failing to recognize the greatness of the situation. This is the Tiger Woods pre-sex scandal, Michael Jordan, Muhammad Ali of reality TV.
Yeah, I mean, his performance has been great, and especially how he affects this, you know, I'm this great, like, Don Juan lover, and I don't care anymore, and then the minute that Sammy Sweetheart went with the other guy, he turned into, like, every nerdy, jealous guy that's, like, always around and, like, always trying to, like, you know, and he's like, I don't care, it's all right. And obviously he's, like, brokenhearted on the inside and wants to cry.
But even then it was a situation.
But he was still the situation.
If I was running ESPN right now, first of all, he would be immediately thrown into all of our TV coverage as a sideline reporter. As long as he was dressed the way he dresses. And he would be our NBA guy and shirtless.
Well, obviously. No, he has to wear a shirt so he could have the ability to pull his shirt up to show the situation.
I'm here with Doc Rivers. Doc, what do you think of my abs?
Have you seen the situation?
Doc, why haven't I had sex this week? What are your thoughts? I just can't get enough of him. The look on his face, everything about him. I watched two TMZ clips with him. I haven't enjoyed a random television character, I don't think, ever.
You know what else has been, you know what's been eye-opening for me about the Jersey Shore is just how dog-eat-dog and high-pressure the world of beachfront T-shirt sales is.
Oh, my God.
The guy kind of overreacted last week and really, like, works these kids to death. Like, you're selling T-shirts that say, like, I love the situation and short shorts. I mean, the guy's really like, he's like Donald Trump running that thing down there. Gordon Gekko, take it easy.
He obviously it's a lucrative business.
Clearly, God. I mean, I think I may invest in some beachfront T-shirt stores for next summer.
You know who's happy about the situation?
Who's that?
Tiger Woods. I think it's knocked him. Knocked him a little bit out of the public consciousness. Not that he's not embedded in it, but at least we have the situation to also talk about.
Yeah, something else to bring up at holiday parties. Because I'll be, you know, you wrote your 40,000-word essay on Tiger Woods last week, and you talked about how that would be the subject at every holiday party, which is correct. But you know what the other subject at every holiday party that I've been to is? The Jersey Shore.
Yes.
So it's perfect. It's good. It's good for the situation to take some heat off Tiger. That's good. You're right.
They said the ratings doubled from the first show into the second one. And MTV is weird because they showed a million times. But
yeah.
The actual first showing on last Wednesday night was double the rating of the previous week.
Well, now there's controversy, so it's going to, like, draw a lot of eyeballs to it because of, you know, people that are upset about the stereotype nature of it and because when the girl gets punched in the face on this week's episode, although they're cutting that out now. But, yeah, there's a lot of controversy, so it's going to be huge. I saw online today on the Internet that they were, like, four of them were at some Spike TV Awards or something last night, like on stage with Mike Tyson.
Mm.
They've already entered the Tyson Zone.
they've been in Hollywood for a while, and they're banging out appearances left and right. I'd at least like the Jersey Shore after show to be 3 hours. I think that's fair. And
really
I think they should have, like, CNN during the presidential election. There should be 12 people in three rows analyzing everything we just saw.
It really should be analyzed like the Zapp Bruder film after every episode. there's so many angles where it could be broken down from and just replayed. And what were you thinking here? Or, well, not that you were thinking, but what happened here, you know?
What would you have been thinking here if your brain worked?
Exactly.
Last thing, Johnny, I read this book called JFK, The Unspeakable. Assassination book, best one I've read. I'm not convinced it was the CIA. I'm 100% in. CIA and Oswald. But may either working separately or together, but...
I liked your theory last week in the aforementioned Tiger Woods article where it was Oswald and someone else at the same time that they were unaware of each other's presence.
That was my old theory, but now I've gone back to... I'm talking myself into the two Oswalds.
I think it was Oswald by himself. You should read Gerald Posner's book, Case Closed. It's very definitive about it was just Oswald.
Except for the part where it was an exit wound in the back of JFK's head. I think that's a good thesis.
It's not true. It's just the way – it was the trajectory of the bullet. It was tumbling. It was Oswald by himself.
Please.
We don't want it to be – you know, the president gets shot. You don't want it to be this loser, outcast loner. But unfortunately, that's what it was.
A loser, outcast loner who had serious, extensive CIA ties?
I don't think so. They wouldn't have CIA ties with a guy that went to Russia. He wasn't that swift.
We'll talk about
this further.
We'll continue this next time. Enjoy the holidays. Happy Hanukkah. Merry
Christmas. Maybe we can have a podcast where Snooki joins us with some of her assassination theories as well.
If I could get the situation to come on, we're going to do it.
We'll solve this thing.
All right, Johnny. Take care.
All right. See ya.
Target the Santa.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
This concludes another installment of the BS Report. And with all the talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important news, which frankly cannot go unstated. Whether tailgating, watching the game with friends, or just really hungry, attack your hunger with Subway Catering. Pile-high platters starting at $25, giant subs, cookies, drinks, and more. So find a reason to party, put Subway Catering in charge, and get busy feasting. Subway. Cater fresh.